Hello and welcome to Season 2, Episode 8, the season finale, as well as the Christmas edition of the Summer Library Podcast. I am Paul Sorrell, joined along with Santa's helper, Stephen Mount.
Merry Christmas, Mr. Sorrell.
Well, that's better than bah humbug, I guess. How are you, my friend?
Yeah, I'm doing okay. How are you doing?
I'm well, and today marks 2 weeks before Christmas Day, so there's a lot to be done, I am sure, by a lot of people. Of course, some people, there's nothing to be done. They've either A, got it all done, or B, they're not.
They're going to wait till the last minute. Some of them wait till the Christmas Eve to
do it at all. So, wherever you fall into that, we hope that you do have a nice holiday. So, as we are a couple of weeks away from Christmas, that means we are in the middle of exam week.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yes. Yeah. It's always a nice time of year, isn't it?
Yeah, the kids are running around frantically trying to get all their stuff done, getting their last minutes of studying in before the exams.
Yes. And we've been busy in the library.
Been very busy, yeah.
People in all the chairs at all the tables. And we had a very nice Christmas reception for our patrons yesterday. And hopefully if you got by, you got some nice treats to eat and got to visit and all those kind of good things that happen at receptions.
We talked last time that you were going to be in a musical, The Music Man.
Why, yes, we did.
Yeah, how did that go?
Well, it went okay.
I saw it. I think it went better than okay.
Well, I appreciate you coming, as well as I appreciate all the people who did come from the library. That was very nice of them. Yes, it was. There are times when you wish you had done better in certain things and places in the show, but all in all, it was a good experience. I enjoyed working with the folks up in Huntington, and it's a great venue, and it's a great musical, and yes, it was a good experience, and but I am glad that it is over, because it takes a lot of...
You're doing a lot of practicing, a lot of driving to and from Huntington.
Yes, but believe it or not, I am not tired of the music or the musical, and I probably, if somebody asked me, I could do it next week after a little rust removal.
Yeah.
But
it was very good.
Well, thank you.
Enjoyed it. I heard positive reviews from everybody who attended.
Well, thank you. The only thing that is lasting from it that I wish would go away is the hair color that I put in my hair.
It's still hanging out. Yeah.
Yeah. I put it in about 4.5 weeks ago, and on the box it says 4 to 6 weeks, you know, and I'm thinking, no, it's going to be like 6 to 8 weeks, and I'm just waiting for my natural color hair to come back, which is silver gray, which is fine with me. I just don't, you know.
Well, I'll get used to this new hair color, and then you'll have your natural hair color back, and we'll have to get used to that.
I know what, you know, one thing, and this is too much about my hair, but
the hair episode.
Yeah. One thing that I did, I'm thinking, wow, I'm aging all over again. You know, you know, it's like your hair is
a microcosm
gray
of time.
Again. Yes. And it's like, wait a minute, I've done this before. Uh-huh. And now, yeah, it's, you know, time elapsed. It's really quickly. Anyway, so. What about movies, man? Have you
enough
seen
about
any movies?
Your hair? Let's talk about movies.
Let's talk about some movies.
I've seen a couple in theaters. I think it was maybe back-to-back days over our Thanksgiving holiday.
Okay.
When we had a babysitter for the kid.
Wow.
My wife's parents. We saw Lincoln.
Yeah.
And we saw the James Bond movie Skyfall.
I saw Skyfall, and I do want to see Lincoln. But did you like Lincoln?
It was a very interesting movie. He's definitely going to get some award nominations for that,
yeah.
Playing that role, Daniel Day-Lewis,
right.
For playing Lincoln. It was very good. He did a very good job that role.
Did it start toward the end of his presidency, like maybe just a couple months
it
before
focused
he was assassinated?
On his desire to end slavery,
okay.
And to end the war,
okay.
And trying to do both of those things in one fell swoop as opposed to do one than the other. He was
right.
That was the main focus.
Right. And, of course, Skyfall is totally different.
Now for something completely different.
Yeah.
Yeah, the James Bond. What did you think of it?
You know, it was what I expected it to be. A lot of blowing up of things and impossible situations that
sure.
He comes through with, well, I was going to say without a scratch, but no, he gets shot and you think he's dead at the beginning of the movie, but he's not.
But we knew that wasn't the case.
Of course not. I'm not giving anything away from that. So, no. But you know, it was what it was.
Yeah.
And it's okay.
It was decent. Yeah.
But the movie I'm looking forward to, and I think you are looking forward to seeing,
yes,
comes out on Christmas Day, 2 weeks from today. And I won't be watching it on Christmas Day, but that is Les Miserables.
Yes.
And that is my favorite all-time Broadway musical and a dream of mine.
I think because of you, I saw the Liam Neeson cinema version.
Okay.
I really liked the story of Les Mis.
Yes, there. It's a great story.
And I've been looking forward to this one. It has some very good actors.
Yes.
Some A-list actors in it.
Hugh Jackman was on 60 Minutes Sunday, and they were showing some clips of the show and how they went about recording the soundtrack. And usually singers and orchestras and actors will go into a recording studio weeks before production starts and record it. And then when they get on set, they are just lip syncing it. Well, this was totally different, where they were wearing an earpiece and someone was off stage from where they were playing a piano, so they could do it in real time. And of course, then they came back and put the orchestrations under that in post-production. But this way, the actors had a better opportunity to emote. And he gave a few examples of how the song was written and then how he was able to do it. And then they showed the clip of him doing it the more introspective way. And it was just amazing. It was amazing. I'm really looking forward to that movie.
Yeah, it should be very good.
And if you've never seen the Broadway musical live, we in the library have the 10th and 25th anniversary DVD of the concert production. Of course, it's in costumes and a little bit of set pieces, but it's very good. So if you aren't familiar with the story, or if you aren't familiar with the musical and the music, then we have that where you can become more acquainted with it.
And those are sung through completely.
Right.
But you said this movie that's coming out is not completely sung through.
Right. It has some dialogue from a few clips I saw. I'm looking forward to it, and I think it'll be hopefully an award-winning movie.
Yeah, since it's the Christmas edition of the podcast.
Is this the Christmas edition?
It's the Christmas edition and the hair edition as well, but we've already talked about that. So what are some of your favorite Christmas songs that you hear at this time of the season that you have to hear for the season to feel like Christmas to you?
Well, my favorite Christmas song, my favorite secular Christmas song, is Christmas Time Is Here by the Vince Guaraldi Trio, which appears on the Charlie Brown Christmas special. And there's something just very cool about that song. And there's two versions. There's the one instrumental version, and then there's the one with the vocals with the kids singing. And every time I hear that, man, I'm just transported back to another time in my
nostalgic
life. Absolutely. Yeah. And I read somewhere where somebody described it as being melancholy. And as you and I were talking about this song yesterday, and you found the lyrics, there's really nothing melancholy about the lyrics. Maybe the last one a little bit, where it's why can't this kind of be all year round?
Mm-hmm.
But the music, it's kind of in a minor key, and it's kind of a soft jazz, and I dig that kind of stuff. So
yeah,
that's me. And my favorite sacred carol is God Rest You Merry Gentlemen.
Yeah, that's a good one.
What about you, Mr. Mount?
I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day is one of my favorites.
Okay.
There's a fairly current version. This album has been out for probably longer than I realize, but a Christian group called Mercy Me has a version of I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day. I like that a lot.
Yeah.
It's got good.
And anything by William Hung, right?
That's right, yeah. Obviously, that goes without saying, but
I believe you have this Christmas
Yeah, somebody gave me that for Christmas. But that guy had silver hair, so I'm not sure. He must not be among us.
Not here today.
Yeah, so I have the William Hung Christmas album.
That's great.
And break that out. And with the family, we all sing to tunes of William Hung.
And if anyone who is not familiar with William Hung, he was a contestant on one of the early seasons of American Idol, and he just could not sing, but remarkably had some kind of funky career because of how
he was
bad.
So bad he was interesting.
Yes, and actually somebody produced CDs with him
yes,
singing.
Yes, 3 or 4 CDs at yeah. least, I think.
Yeah, and it's just, he's hilariously bad. And I don't know if he realizes that he's bad.
He has to, right?
You would hope. Man, you would hope. But so I heard the bells on Christmas Day. Any secular song that you like?
You know, the I'll Be Home for Christmas is always mm-hmm. kind of a, just a kind of, you just kind of sit down, you can have some hot chocolate, you know, just kind of, you know, it's good, kind of nostalgic kind of tune.
Right.
That one kind of brings you down a little bit, yeah.
And since this is the Christmas episode, we are very delighted.
Is it the Christmas episode?
That's what I heard.
Oh, okay.
That's what somebody said, I don't know. But we are delighted to have Dr. Randall Bush, who is a professor here at Union, obviously, but he is also the author of 3 Christmas books. How about that? Christmas books, Christmas time.
How ironic.
How ironic. And he will be joining us, and we'll be discussing his Christmas books. And for the first time on one of our podcasts, we have a special treat. He will be reading from
Very nice.
One of his books, his latest book, The Mailbox Tree. And we'll be right back with Dr. Randall Bush right after this. Dr. Randall Bush is the professor of philosophy and Christian studies here at Union. He holds 2 earned doctorates, a Ph.D. from Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Fort Worth, Texas, and a doctorate of philosophy from the University of Oxford. While at Oxford, he was a tutor for the examination schools and served as the director of the graduate seminar at Regent's Park College. Upon returning from Oxford, he was the Rockwell Visiting Theologian at the University of Houston. Among his academic publications is a work of the doctrine of the Trinity entitled Recent Ideas of Divine Conflict. His other works include a fantasy novel, The Quest for Asden, and 3 children's Christmas books, Gabriel's Magic Ornament, Widgeomus World, and the recently published 3rd book in the series, The Mailbox Tree. We are delighted to have Dr. Bush join us on our podcast today. Welcome.
Thanks, Paul. It's really good to be with you today and to talk about my experiences in writing children's books.
Well, I want to know, first of all, were there storytellers in your family?
Oh, yes. My grandfather was a storyteller, and I suppose I have also known some very good storytellers in my past who I have mimicked. One of them was a missionary by the name of Mildred McWhorter, who was a missionary for about 35 years in the Houston Hispanic communities there. And, oh, she was a very humorous lady and told all kinds of stories. So I learned some things from her, certainly.
Now, when did you feel like you had this in you to become a storyteller? Were you telling stories as a child? Not fibs, but
well,
stories.
Well, I've done some of those too, unfortunately, for which I have repented. But the fact is, yes, my sister and I used to make up soap operas on cassette players, and we would work very hard at them. And we had several that we did. We did a Chinese version of Gone with the Wind at one point.
Oh, wow.
And and they were all humorous. We once did a skit on Mr. and Mrs. Santa Claus dressed in garbage bags who were very – and I was very, very skinny at the time. And so it was like we've had a very hard year, and Mrs. Santa Claus said that she did not have enough money for food, so she ended up making the elves – some mistletoe berry pies, and that 6 of the elves died instantly, and the other 6 were permanently disabled.
Oh, my. Wow. Talk about a blue Christmas.
Yes. We had a lot of fun. We did that at several churches. So
so this is just a natural part of
It's a natural
of
part of what I do. I did take creative writing in college, and I've learned over the years some tricks of doing creative writing.
Mm-hmm.
And And it's hard, really, for a philosopher, for most of the time our heads are in the clouds, but I find that one way of getting across important theological and philosophical truths to children is through narrative.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And my books, all of them, have layered meaning. They of course, they have the superficial plot line that sort of carries you along, but there are these deeper layers that I'm always trying to put into the stories as well.
Right. Now, this reminds me of just going to movies these days where it's really a children's movie, but it's geared more toward an adult.
Yeah.
And reading your books, I mean, obviously they're like you say, they're layers.
I write children's books for adults is mm-hmm. the truth of the matter.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, so did J.R.R. Tolkien.
You know,
when he wrote The Hobbit, it was more of a children's book. But when The Lord of the Rings came out, then it was a different genre, and they didn't have any place for it.
Mm-hmm.
I learned this recently from my friend Hal Poe, who is an authority on Tolkien and Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that you have to feel for parents who have to sit there and read to their children. So you want to write for them as well.
Right.
So that they can enjoy, you know, participating in that experience.
When did you feel comfortable writing? Is that something along with storytelling that you've always done?
I have, you know, been writing, as I said, since college. And the thing about the once that's in your blood, you have to do it.
Mm.
It's not something that you do to make money or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that is part of your creativity.
Right.
And so that's why I have continued on, and I get these ideas, and I feel like I've just got to get them out.
Right.
And it's really a good counterbalance to teaching philosophy
mm-hmm.
Because, you know, with philosophy, you get into a very abstract thought. But this keeps my feet on terra firma,
right.
so to speak.
Right. Now, if you were presented with an idea of, okay, Randall, you can write a philosophy book or a children's book, which one would you write?
I would rather write a children's book, although I'm committed to doing an introduction to philosophy, and it's very, very painful to write. But the children's books are so much more fun.
Yes.
And I have the suspicion that the children's books are the ones that people will read, because
right.
how many people actually get a kick out of reading philosophy textbooks.
Right, right. Now, specifically, you have written this series, which I believe is called The Christmas Tree Tales.
That is a name that the publisher, Borderstone, has decided to put on the series. And the series, it's unlike perhaps some other series, like the Harry Potter series, in that there is a common theme that runs through all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it is actually based upon the four living creatures found in the book of Revelation.
Oh, okay.
The man, the ox, the lion, and the eagle.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that these creatures were interpreted in one way as those angelic forces that were there at the turn of the seasons of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first one, of course, it's the man, and the second one, the bull, and the third one, the lion, and the fourth one, which is hopefully to come out next year, will be the eagle. And it really talks about the progress of this world as it comes into being and then finally passes away.
Mm-hmm.
And so the next one will be dealing with realities in the beyond and heaven as sort of the decorating of a Christmas tree.
Okay.
And stories that we know here in this world about people, and we hear a story usually drawn out over a period of time. But imagine being able to see a person's entire life story like a snapshot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's like an ornament on a Christmas tree.
Okay.
So I've got ideas there.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I also have to put in a place called Bar Bay, mm-hmm. which is going to be the bargain basement, and it's going to be the antechamber to a not-so-nice place.
Okay.
But I feel like in teaching children certain truths, we have to talk about the consequences of our lives here,
sure,
and where this all leads.
Right.
That is important, the decisions
the whole truth.
We make.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the whole truth.
Was
yes.
the original intent for this to be a series, or did you write the first one and then say, hey, this went pretty
well?
It was
in my mind, yes, but whether it would actually have become a series was questionable. Fortunately, Borderstone has picked these up, and so I'm pretty much free now to go ahead and develop this series. Mm. So, yeah, that's been a very good thing for me.
Yeah, I read the first book and enjoyed it very much, but couldn't help but notice maybe you have something against tinsel. Is this
is
this the case? Yeah,
that's right. Garlands of tinsel.
Yeah.
And it goes back to my mother, who thought tinsel looked cheap on the Christmas tree. She did not like tinsel. And so this was something that I just got this idea. And I don't want to give the story away about what happens to the tinsel, but or how that tinsel gets on the tree. But yeah, tinsel is something cheap, and it's something that is countered in a way by the golden ornament, which is very expensive. And of course, in the story, in Gabriel's Magic Ornament, where they visit Santa Claus convention, if you remember that part, where none of the Santa Clauses there believes there really is a Santa Claus. And of course, when I talk about Santa Claus, I'm talking about the true St. Nicholas, who actually was a bishop in the early Christian church.
Bishop of Myra.
The Bishop of Myra. And of course, there is room for us to rediscover in our own time the real meaning of the person of St. Nicholas and what he actually stood for. Mm-hmm. And that's actually going to be a theme, or is a theme, in the mailbox tree, where St. Nicholas figures throughout in various venues. And, of course, the one that I prefer is the one of him as the Bishop of Myra.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you see yourself as another Tolkien, another Lewis?
No, I'm just Randall Bush, and I enjoy writing in that style.
Mm-hmm.
And I was,
but you wouldn't necessarily turn down an offer to turn these to movies, would you?
Well, I would be glad to do it if the essential Christian message is not jettisoned,
right?
It's an interesting story about the first book, because right after it came out, it was the first review I received was from the School Library Journal, and it was written by someone who was very anti-Christmas, and it was really quite unfortunate that the review pretty well trashed the book because it was too Christian. The symbolism was too Christian, and the moral was too overt. So I began to think about this, and I thought, well, maybe the symbolism is too Christian, and the moral is too overt, so I'll write another one, and I'll use the initials of the reviewer for the main character of the next book. And in this one, the symbolism will not be overtly Christian, and the moral will not be too overt, but the truth does come through.
Mm.
You can use a villain to highlight truth by giving negative examples as well as using positive examples. So, and my wife tells me, don't tell people that. But I just can't help it, and I really thank the lady for giving me a character that I could actually use. You know?
So this was Widgmas?
This is
world?
Where, Verbata Widgmud is the character. Yeah.
That's hilarious. That's funny.
Now, we recognize something that the books have almost doubled in length each time. Now, what's
true.
Up with that?
Well, that is because the story is unfolding more and more as I get through. But the third one is, of course, in two parts.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason it ended up being as long as it is because it contains the history of Christmas.
Mm.
And when you're dealing with history, you don't want to shortchange people.
Right.
So in my research on this, I actually went back and did some study on the architecture of places, the way it would have looked at the particular time in history. I read letters and diaries and sermons and did historical research. And so all of that, I felt like it was important to make the historical episodes in the mailbox tree as convincing as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's not just history. It also is a fantasy.
Right.
But I've tried as much as possible to make the history pure. Mm-hmm. I don't want to go back and rewrite history. I want to let it represent what actually happened as much as I can, although it is historical fiction.
Right.
And so when I have the characters in the mailbox tree, Grant and Alex, who just happen to be my nephews by my two nieces, mm-hmm. and I've decided to put them into the story. And Grant and Alex travel back to the days leading up to the Jewish festival of Hanukkah.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt it was important to get Hanukkah in there because Hanukkah is such an important part of the period of time around the winter solstice that we celebrate Christmas. So I just wanted to get that in there, and I tie it in, of course, to the whole storyline. Really, it's that idea of Hanukkah, and particularly symbolism taken from the book of Daniel,
mm-hmm.
Is integrated into the whole narrative from the very beginning of the story to the very end of the story.
How long has it taken you to write these books? Has it gotten easier as time goes on, or because you're including more historical background and you have to do more, say, research? What have you found?
Well, that's a very good question, because I can remember writing Gabriel's in the process of maybe 3 weeks. It just poured out.
Oh, wow.
And, of course, the revision of it took much longer. That's the one thing about writing is you just always have to go back and revise. You have to go back and develop your characters and all mm-hmm. that sort of thing. So that didn't take too terribly long. Witchmas World took a little bit longer because I got the main idea for it and I was developing it, but I needed to bring it to a conclusion. It took me a little bit longer to figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the mailbox tree, it's very interesting about that because I got the idea of time travel inside a Christmas tree from the fact that my grandmother, who, of course, would be Paul, your third cousin twice removed. Paul and I are fifth cousins. But anyway, she figures very prominently in the mailbox tree as well. And certain things about her, one of the things is the fact that she made these mailboxes for us for Christmas okay. out of yarn and put the dates of the years.
Hmm.
And so we have all these, still to this very day, all these mailboxes all over our tree.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, you know, I'm going to get her into this story somehow, and that's her. We called her Nanny,
mm-hmm.
and so I'm going to get Nanny into this story. And I had remember all these stories about her of how at one time she soloed in an airplane. She was quite an interesting lady.
Wow.
She soloed in an airplane, so I guess she was a sort of an Amelia Earhart, even though she was well after the time of Amelia Earhart. But so I have her flying a plane from one time in history to another, and the boys accompany her on their trip. And as they do, they learn these family stories
mm-hmm.
that sort of naturally give a background for the places that they're getting ready to go
mm-hmm.
and visit.
Mm-hmm. And you have a genuine interest in genealogy.
Yes, I do.
So I am sure that this weaves its way in.
Yes,
into
I
your
did.
Stories.
In fact, one of the things that, of course, and Paul and I share this genealogy going all the way back to the Emperor Charlemagne and before,
mm-hmm.
And several sides of our family that go back to that. So he is a great-granddaddy.
Mm.
And, of course, he's also the great-granddaddy probably of most Europeans, if the truth is known, because it's been a long time ago, and there's been a lot of interbreeding since. But anyway, the fact of the matter is that Nanny, who when she's flying the plane is a younger version of herself, so they call her Young Nanny,
mm.
brings out this sort of scroll that has the family tree on it and informs them that they're getting ready to go and visit great-granddaddy Charlemagne on Christmas Day of the year 800, which, of course, was the day of his coronation as Holy Roman Emperor.
Okay.
And so they meet Granddaddy Charlemagne. They meet Einhard, who was his biographer, and they sit across the table from Einhard and Alcuin of York as they're talking about Charlemagne and how displeased he is that the Pope has taken upon himself to make him Holy Roman Emperor. And what is this going to do in upsetting the Byzantines? And so there's all this concern that comes out. And they're, in the meantime, eating, or they're not actually eating because they can't eat things from the past, but they are with their imaginations, partaking of this boar's head feast, which in some of the most awful food is served there, like dormice that are dipped in honey and rolled in poppy seed and things like that. So it's just really a journey back into history.
Mm-hmm.
And while they're visiting Charlemagne, they also visit the trees, a room that is called the Trees of the Palace. And they learn in this room of the fact that the Christmas tree is the Christian answer to pagan tree worship that involved, of all things, human sacrifice and sometimes the sacrifice of children.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that Christmas has become a holiday for children shows the Christianization of that holiday as it has come from being a time when children were actually sacrificed to these tree gods.
Mm-hmm.
And this was true among the ancient Romans because of the association of Saturnalia with the god Saturn and the fact that Saturn was the god of time who devoured his own children. And also going back to the mythology of the ancient Celts, the Druids, the Saxons, and the Norse that all involved these various versions of tree worship involving human sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And I try not to make it explicit, but there are references to it throughout.
Right. What do you think of our present-day celebration of Christmas?
Oh, we're celebrating the Festival of Saturnalia, there's no doubt about it. In fact, this is one of the reasons why a very important message I'm trying to get across in all of my books is a message about the true meaning of Christmas and against the secular version of the holiday, which has really taken over in most everybody's mind. And so in the mailbox tree, Verbeta Widgemud, who creates these little creatures out of mud pies that are called Widgemudgeons, and she animates them by the use of her cyberbonnet, which spins out green laser webs across which crawl pink electrical spiders into the minds of these Widgemudgeons, who then dredge this stuff from the bottom of tinsel canal that is called RAP, R-A-A-P, which, of course, being a philosopher, I had to get a little philosophy in there, reduction ad absurdum powder, and reduction ad absurdum means reduction to absurdity. And she uses this and loads it into what's called her secular ray. Now, that's deliberately to refer to secularism. And the secular ray gun is used to shoot anything that has meaning. And so if you have a choir of Christmas carolers, you shoot them, and suddenly, you know, they begin to their music degenerates until it begins to sound like rap music. But even the rap music is too rhythmic and has too much rhyme, and so she has to shoot them again even to take that meaning out.
Now, going back to the critic of your first book,
yes,
who obviously is, you know, part of all the books from now on, I guess.
Yeah, she does end up in the Cemetery of the Scrooges as well, which is a portion I want to read today.
But. Okay. When she said that your book was too Christian.
Yeah, the symbolism is too Christian.
Okay. obviously Christmas. What is her view of Christmas?
See, I suspect if it had been a book on Hanukkah, she would not have said that the symbolism was too Jewish.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and in fact, the symbolism in the first book, much of it does come from the Old Testament. There mm-hmm. is an allusion there, mm-hmm. even in that book, to the lighting of the Hanukkah menorah, mm-hmm. when the lights that illuminate the stairs that spiral upward to treetop, are they all go out at one point and they have to be relit. Mm. And the one star, of course, in the Hebrew faith, the everlasting light was known as the Ner Tamid. And that would have been the perpetual light that was never allowed to be extinguished. But after the Hanukkah menorah was extinguished and had to be lit again after the time of the Seleucids, and particularly Antiochus IV, they used that Ner Tamid, the light from that, to light the Hanukkah lights, which is a way of saying that God is the everlasting light of Israel.
Hmm.
Well, that everlasting light idea appears also very prominently in Christian.
Right.
For example, in thy dark streets shineth the everlasting light.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Christ as the coming of the light. And that's why the star at treetop represents the everlasting light of God.
Mm-hmm.
It has dimensions on the outside, but it is infinite on mm-hmm. the inside,
mm-hmm.
which is perhaps another way of describing the fact that God, who is infinite, can become incarnate mm-hmm. in a finite reality
mm-hmm.
and does so as Jesus of Nazareth.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, there's all that symbolism that's there that I would not say is completely Christian, but also has its roots back in Judaism.
Right, right. Now, you had mentioned that you were going to read a passage of your book for us and our listeners.
I'm going to read from chapter 6 of The Mailbox Tree, and at this point, the boys have just now begun their time travel. And they travel, first of all, to the year 2525. And, of course, there's an allusion there to that old song
mm-hmm.
back in the days when I was a young person in the year 2525, which was a sort of an apocalyptic kind of song.
Mm-hmm.
So they end up at a place called the Cemetery of the Scrooges. So here we go. When Grant and Alex reached the end of the dirty, dimly lit corridor, they again entered what appeared to be the inside of a green mailbox. But Alex stopped dead in his tracks when he caught sight of the mailbox door. Grant, be sure the Sphinx is not out there. The Sphinx is the creature that represents time, and it devours everything. So they're afraid of the Sphinx. Slowly and carefully, his brother opened the door. When he did, a wave of heat rushed in, and he quickly shut it. Young Nanny was right about the weather here, he said. It's pretty hot. He opened it far enough to stick out his head and look around. The coast is clear, I think, he told Alex. Cautiously, Grant and Alex ventured outside and stood beneath a pitch-black sky inside a cemetery with thousands of tombstones. The tombstones dotted the side of what appeared to be the slope of an immense volcano. But the volcano looked vaguely like a gigantic Christmas tree whose wood had become petrified into black stone. Inside, instead of a star at the top of this petrified tree, the volcanic cone was belching smoke and spewing lava. The lava crept slowly down the side of the mountain, and the boys knew that they would not have much time before it reached them. As they got closer and looked at the gravestones, they noticed something extremely odd. All the markers had last names ending in Scrooge. I'm afraid there may be ghosts here, Alex declared as he looked at the tombstones. No sooner had he said this than out of one of the graves a ghost figure emerged. It wore a gray hooded robe made of coarse material, and instead of a face with eyes peering out from under the hood, the boys could only see empty darkness. Still, despite the absence of eyes, they could almost feel it staring straight through them. Its hands and feet were those of a skeleton, though somehow its gnarled and twisted fingernails had managed to remain attached to its bony fingers. A black robe tied around its waist revealed that only bone lay beneath the garment as well. The ghostly figure grew until it became very tall and towered over them. Alex, trembling, grabbed Grant's arm and whispered. "Be brave," Grant urged him. "If it's a ghost, it may sense your fear. It's best not to let it think you're scared." Then Grant shouted at the ghost using the most courageous voice he could muster. "Who are you and what do you want?" The strange being said nothing, but slowly and deliberately turned, lifted his right hand, and pointed its bony index finger with its twisted fingernail at a pedestal with a book on it. Next to the pedestal stood a statue of a hunched-over man holding a sickle like the kind used to cut down weeds. "We won't go," Grant exclaimed. "Not until you tell us who you are." The being did not speak, but again flung out his arm and pointed his finger in the direction of the pedestal holding the book. The moment he did this, the ground rumbled and fire belched out of the cone of volcano. "Better do what he wants," Alex warned, "or he might kill us." "Okay," Grant agreed. "Just be ready to run back in the direction of the mailbox as fast as you can, okay?" Alex nodded. The ghostly being led the boys to the pedestal and pointed to a book that rested on it. Next to the book were oven mitts and a steel spatula like the kind Mom used to fry bacon and turn pancakes. The book looked vaguely like a waffle iron. Its binding seemed to be made of cast iron, and on its cover were the words in raised, glowing red letters, "Read me if you dare." Grant started to open the book, but the hooded figure grabbed his arm and yanked it away before he could touch it. The ghostly being then picked up the oven mitts, handed them to Grant, and signaled for him to put them on. "The book must be hot," Alex guessed. "Looks that way," Grant said, slipping on the oven mitts. The second he opened the book to the first page, the boys felt heat flare up against their faces. It was like the heat that escapes when opening an oven door to peek at chocolate chip cookies baking. Only this time, the heat did not carry anything remotely resembling a sweet and enticing aroma. Instead, it carried the odor of central heating when it is first turned on in the autumn. The odor intensified until its stench was like that of burnt toast. Then it got even worse until it smelt like burnt electrical wiring. Grant vigorously flapped his mitt over the book, trying to get rid of the toxic fumes escaping from it. An inscription on the first page of the book read, "Ask any question you dare, but stand back." The letters seemed to be engraved into the page as though they were made by a wood-burning tool. The center parts of them were black, but their edges were brown and a bit raggedy. "Okay," said Grant, thinking for a moment. "What question should I ask it first?" Suddenly, fire flared up in his face, slightly singeing his eyebrows. Immediately, he jumped back and patted his face with the oven mitts. A startled look flashed across his face, and he shouted, "Why did it do that?" Again, without warning, the book flared like a box of matches set on fire, but this time Grant managed to jump back before the fire burned his eyebrows off completely. Immediately, the page he noticed had two answers. To the question, "What question should I ask it first?" the answer appeared, "You just asked it, silly." And to the question, "Why did it do that?" the answer read, "Because you asked me a silly question. Ask me a silly question and you will get a silly answer." "You better not ask it any more questions," Alex suggested. Grant frowned. "I didn't mean to ask it a silly question, dummy. What kind of stupid book is this?" The book flared again, and when the flame died down, the words appeared, "Saying I'm stupid is like the pot calling the kettle black. Look in the mirror." Alex's face was smug. "Another silly question." "Thank you, smarty," Grant returned. "Now I've got to be careful and not ask it any questions I don't mean to. From now on, I won't ask anything unless I think about it first." "Good idea," said Alex. Grant positioned himself. "Okay, here goes. Who is the scary person in the gray hood standing behind me?" This time nothing happened. Grant huffed. Oh, great. Now the thing is broken. The scary person in the gray hood picked up the spatula and handed it to Alex. And what am I supposed to do with this? He asked. At that moment, Alex realized he had unintentionally asked another question. He fully expected the fire to flare up from the page, but this time nothing happened. I think the scary person wants you to use the spatula to turn the pages, Grant ventured. Alex followed Grant's suggestion, slid the spatula in under page one, and turned to page two. Then he carefully set the spatula down on the pedestal next to the book. Okay, I'll try again, Grant said. Who is the scary person in the gray hood standing beside me? Fire flared out from the book, and when it died down, these words appeared. Once upon a time, the scary person you see standing before you was the bright and hopeful Angelus Novum, which means the angel of the new. He is the time guardian of the future. But now that the future is so bleak and hopeless, he grieves in silence, refusing to speak. He has ceased to be a time guardian because there is nothing worth guarding here. Time in this place has run out. Grant patted his chin with the oven mitt as he thought up another question. Why have these things happened? He asked. The fire flared, died down, and left behind these words. Christmas in the year 2525 is dead, and no memories of any previous Christmases can be found. I think I should stop there.
That sounds really good. Yeah.
Anyway, it's fun, but they find out that the cemetery of the Scrooges, that all of them, they either were Scrooges who did not believe there was such a thing as Tree King, so they're basically atheists who, in this case, they are also likened to vampires because just as vampires shrink and in horror when they see crosses, these particular vampire Scrooges shrink in horror whenever they see a nativity scene. You know, so that's kind of
Like the ACLU.
Yeah, kind of like what is happening today in our own culture. So I thought I would kind of bring some humor into it, and all that is developed in the later chapters in the book.
Very good reading, and we certainly do appreciate you taking your time and coming and being our guest on our Christmas edition.
You're certainly welcome. I enjoyed it very much.
Now, where can people buy any of your books, especially because I was not able to find The Mailbox Tree on Amazon yet?
Yes, I know. One of the reasons that Borderstone has not put it on Amazon was because of Hurricane Sandy had messed up some of their delivery systems, and he was afraid that people would not be able to actually get it before Christmas. But actually, Borderstone Press, and if you go to www.borderstonepress.com, they're offering actually the whole set for $40 and I think $3 shipping and handling, and they will include in that a book by Ellen Kay, her little fantasy, and this is free, that she's the one who actually designed the covers for the books.
And the cover changed on your first book from the original to what looks like now kind of a concerted effort to make it all seem of one series.
That's right. And I think that was, of course, a good thing. I like the cover on the first book. The new one, I think, is very finely done. And they leave a lot up to the imagination as well. So,
Yeah, it's very nice.
Yeah. But BorderstonePress.com would be the place to go. Lifeway here in Jackson has them, but you know, of course, part of this is trying to get the word out about these books.
Right.
And I liken it to trying to make it big in Hollywood. You know, it's just it's a very difficult thing in the promotion. So anyone who is listening to this podcast, please obtain your copies and get others to do so as well.
Yes.
Very, very shameless there, right?
Yes, I know. I have to be concerned. And, I'm also wanting to do all I can to help small business because Brian's publishing company is a small publisher. They've just done an amazing amount of work already. I think they have something like 40 titles out.
Wow.
So he's a very hard-working man. And so if you're in favor of small business, please support Borderstone Press.
Absolutely. And we wish you the best in the book sales and your continued writing. and your things that you do here at Union.
Yeah. I will mention one thing, that Borderstone is coming out with the Canterbury Tales that will be out this maybe by late spring or summer. And this is about a clan of cats that take over a medieval cathedral. And it starts with all of their tales on the wall. And, of course, the big question is, how did they get there?
Mm.
And it is a poem, and it sort of does homage to T.S. Eliot and to his old Possum's Book of Practical Cats, which became the basis for the Broadway musical.
Mm-hmm.
But it is being illustrated by Ben Watson,
okay,
who is actually one of our former Union art students.
Oh.
And Ben has done a wonderful, wonderful job on the illustrations. And so I think that is – it's a short book,
mm-hmm,
but I think that one is going to be picked up,
okay,
at some point by maybe hopefully mainstream. But
mm-hmm,
anyway.
Very good. And that comes out in the summer.
It's sometime in the maybe late spring, early summer. We're planning on having a book signing at Blackwell's Bookstore in Oxford during the C.S. Lewis the Inklings Conference that will be there, that is going to be from July the 14th through the end of that week, I believe. It's about a five-day conference. And our own Dr. Hal Poe is coordinating that conference. And so I think Ben, my illustrator, is going to be going, and I will certainly be going. And we will hopefully be doing a book signing there and trying to get the book into some of the cathedrals, since this does take place in a cathedral.
Yeah, very nice. Well, once again, we thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
And we wish you a Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to all, and to all a goodbye.
Take care. And we'll be right back right after this. We would like to thank Dr. Randall Bush again for joining us on our Christmas edition of the Summer Library Podcast. And we wish him well with his book sales. And the next time we meet, it'll be a new year.
2013. I believe it's the one that comes next.
Unless the Mayan prophecies come true, which is like
10 days away.
Yeah, next Friday. Ooh.
So either way.
Either way, we'll be around or not.
Or not.
So we want to wish all of our listeners a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, and let you know how much we appreciate you listening to our podcast over the year. And we will be back next year, next January, February, and we will be into season 3. How about that? And Stephen, it is always good to work with you.
Yes, sir.
And I appreciate your help and your witty comments, your insights, and you always have something interesting to say, and I appreciate that. So, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Happy holidays, and we will see you again soon.
Bye.